MSW Media.
Prevail, c'est un show de Genève programme pro-politico.
L'histoire, la sécurité nationale.
Crimine organisato, dinero sucio.
Globale corruzione. Ta brutto sa democrazia.
Et ora?
ATP.
Et maintenant?
Con ustedes, su anfitrión.
Greg Oléa.
Welcome into the fight. This time I know our side will win.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. Rachel Slade is here. Rachel, of course, is the author of Into the Raging Sea, which is a fantastic book, and she's been on this show before. She has a new book called Making It in America, The Almost Impossible Quest to Manufacture in the USA and How It Got That Way. I talked to her on the phone like 2 years ago, and she was telling me about this book, and it's just really, really fascinating. I love how she writes and how she approaches subjects, because she delves into these things that I didn't even know I was curious about, like, like shipping routes and stuff like that, logistics. This book is about, you know, manufacturing textiles and clothes and the history of it and how it got that way and why manufacturing went overseas and all this stuff. It's totally fascinating. I really enjoyed the book a lot. I think you will too. It's coming out on January 9th and it's called, again, Making It in America. But we don't only talk about that. We talk about a lot of different things. Always fun to talk to her. We talk about NAFTA, we talk about free trade, we talked about the labor movement vis-a-vis the Democratic Party, we talk about how organized crime seeped into unions and the history of that, we talked about Biden and China and the stuff Biden's doing, we talk about Amazon, we talk about capitalism and how capitalism has changed in the last 30 years slightly and how we need to change it back, goddammit. So that's what we discuss. It's a great conversation. Stick around for that. It is almost Christmas. I want to wish everybody listening a Merry Christmas if you observe. And even if you don't observe, you probably have the day off, and I hope that you enjoy it. It's not a very white Christmas here. Upstate New York, it's been a lot of rain. I don't know, can reindeer move through rain effectively? Can they if they have red noses? I don't know. I haven't seen any really. So I don't think we're going to have a white Christmas this year. And honestly, I don't really care. If it's white or not. What's nice is that, you know, Christmas is the solstice or around the solstice. So now the days are going to get longer, which is fantastic because I'm sick of all the darkness. You know, it gets dark at like 3:50 now. It's just crazy. I don't like all this darkness. I want more light. Come back light. And we know that that now it will because the earth spins or something. I don't really understand the mechanics of it, but I know that after the winter solstice, we're going to get longer and longer days, which I welcome. Every year I welcome this. If you're looking for last-minute Christmas presents, I wrote a 700-page book about the Byzantine Empire. That's a great Christmas gift for somebody who's into historical fiction or somebody you just want to give like a white elephant gift to. You know, if you have like a Secret Santa party, what better than a 700-page book about the Byzantine Empire, I say. You know, that's always a good one. You could always give out at the last minute subscriptions to Prevail, my Substack. That would be a great gift for somebody. Gift certificates to local bookstores are nice, I think. There seem to be a lot of scarves hanging around lately. I feel like people are giving scarves a lot now. Maybe they always have. Maybe that's they're trying to manifest the white Christmas by giving the scarf. I don't really know. I want to take a quick gander at the calendar for this Prevail podcast. We have an episode, obviously, today. We're going to have an episode next Friday, the first Friday of the new year, which is January 5th. I will not be on, but I will be on for the three Fridays after that. That's the plan. And then in February, I'm going to take a couple weeks off. So we're going to be with you through the holiday season. Also up front today, there's more Clarence Thomas stuff. It looks like this guy, they just basically paid him off to stay in the job. They made it so that he could, you know, live lavishly and wouldn't leave to go get a better paying job elsewhere. I think this is so mind-bogglingly corrupt. It's the next step below. Here's a suitcase full of $1 million. Rule in our favor, please. I mean, it's very, very close to that. I don't know how this guy can stick around It's really, it's a disgrace, honestly. I don't think we could do anything about it. You know, impeaching him is probably not going to happen, but maybe we have to try, you know, because this sort of corruption should not stand. We shouldn't have corrupt people in government like this running our lives, affecting our lives in the profound way that they do. So I hope Clarence Thomas is not having a Merry Christmas. I hope he's having a shit Christmas. That's what I hope. Ginny, too. I hope these coup-plotting assholes are having a terrible, terrible Christmas. That is my wish for them. All right, enough of my prattle. This is a great episode. Love talking to Rachel. She's always a lot of fun and always teaches me things that I don't know. Stick around. We'll be right back with Rachel Slade.
Have an ultra-mega Christmas. Donald Trump's our mega stud. Build that fence or the immigrants will poison all our blood. Have an ultra-mega Christmas. Here's a Hitler book for you. Kosh Patel will give them hell the next time that we coup. Oh, the mistletoe, two hot chicks and me. I think I'll kiss them both cause they're moms for liberty. Have an ultra-mega Christmas, cause the rapture is quite near. Don't dig up a fauna and we'll have a MAGA Christmas all year.
Rachel Slade, welcome to Prevail.
Hey. Woo, good to be here.
Good to have you back. Always so much fun to talk to you. I have 2 pages of questions. I'm looking forward to getting into all manner of things. You're on now because you've written this book called Making It in America, The Almost Impossible Quest to Manufacture in the USA and How It Got That Way. It's a terrific book. It's coming out on January 9th. So when people are listening, it's going to be like 2 weeks away. You know, I give you 2 weeks notice to buy this book. And what I love about how you write about this stuff is that you find these like really, I don't want to say like very specific, almost arcane topics that I just don't think about, that don't even occur to me at all. And then you manage to plumb the depths and all this interesting stuff comes out of it. And I, you know, my head just is blown a little bit. And it expands my knowledge of just how things work, how things operate. Like, you know, in the past you wrote about shipping and all that, which again, literally never even crossed my mind. I think I saw a boat once, you know, I don't know anything about that. And this is the same way. And I was thinking about how to describe it and how to describe kind of your writing style. And it's like a Dungeons and Dragons module where you have these characters and they go into like room A and then something happens and there's this whole thing there. And then they go to the next room and then something else happens. And there's this whole world in there. And you kind of wend your way through this labyrinth of stuff. And every room is interesting. And it all kind of relates to each other. And at the end, you're just like, I just feel like I learned so much. So it's a really great book. And congratulations to you, is what I say.
Wow. Well, thank you. Not being a Dungeons and Dragons person, I'm going to have to go back and play now to understand the analogy. But I think it's a compliment and I'll take it.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is a compliment. So the first question I have about the book, and we're going to talk about the book. We're going to talk about things in the book. We're going to talk about things that are not in the book. We're going to talk about a lot of things. We're going to talk about things we probably don't even plan on talking about because that's what we do. But last time I talked to you, it might not have been last time. It was probably 2 years ago I talked to you and you were writing this at the time and you were telling me about it and you were excited about it and learning about textiles and all this stuff. But what was the impetus for this particular book? Because you kind of talk about it a little bit at the beginning, but tell everybody, why are you writing about this and why now?
Yeah. So I was raised in a family where Buy American was really important. And I like to tell the story about my dad. So when I was 10 years old, we always had these American cars, right? The Fords, the Oldsmobiles. And when I was 10 years old, my dad drove up to the house in a VW Rabbit, a Volkswagen, which was just kind of earth-shattering for us because this was a foreign car. This was a German car. And my dad made a big point of letting us know that it was built in Pennsylvania, very close to where I was brought up. And That story, I use that story to basically explain that I am somebody who's been obsessed since the very beginning of my life, as far back as I can remember, about the provenance of things. Where do things come from? Who's making my stuff? I don't know. I'm nerding out about that. Was just something that I always did. And I drove people crazy. I still drive my daughter crazy about it. I drive my husband crazy about it. It's like, I need to know where stuff is made. I'm even one of those morons who, I did not come from a sports fan family. I was one of those people who thought that, like, if you're rooting for the Phillies, I'm from Philadelphia. If you're rooting for the Phillies, you're rooting for Philadelphians. I didn't realize that, like, ball players could come from different places and just play for your team for a little while and then leave. I was like, then what are we actually rooting for? So where things are made is very important to me. And then but then always I have understood the power of making with the health of economies. So I think we all know that diversity is the sign of a good economy. And I'm not talking about ethnic, cultural diversity. I'm talking about if you can make lots of different things and produce lots of different things, then you are more likely to weather downtimes better. And you're more likely also to be able to negotiate on the international stage better because you're a little more independent from, you know, others' economies. I'm not a protectionist by any stretch of the imagination, but like I am an American and I care very, very deeply for the fate of our country. And everything that I'm seeing now from, you know, the narrative about what's happening to men in America, like the fate of men in America and how they're not doing that well. From that to our ability to negotiate on the national stage, to our ability to create good environmental policy, whatever it is, I now see it through the lens of manufacturing.
Interesting. You know, the fate of men is that, you know, people have stopped talking about men, Rachel. They've stopped talking about it for 20 minutes in the popular discourse, and men don't like that. We need to go back and find out what's wrong. No.
Wow.
We just like to be talked about constantly. And if God forbid some other topic of conversation comes along, you know, we don't like it. You mentioned about the sports family and or not being a sports family, but rooting for the Phillies and being Philadelphia. Jerry Seinfeld once, you know, making the same point that you just made, said, you know, we're basically rooting for laundry. That's what he's, you know, like the uniform. So, which brings us into the next question. So,
okay.
Yeah, which is about textile manufacturing. Again, something I literally have never thought about at all, like ever in my life. I just am like, okay, here's a shirt. I'm going to put it on now.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know. It just didn't occur to me. I mean, I know on some level, yes, someone must have made this at some point. And I think I knew about the Triangle Building, you know, fire, and that's about it. That's the extent of my knowledge of textile manufacturing. And you go into it at the beginning of the book here in a really interesting way, because it's obviously a very important part of history, not just U.S. history, but world history, because people, once they started figuring out how to make clothes and, you know, textiles, you know, the economy started to boom. We could do more things. Like, one of the things I learned in the book is that Great Britain amassed this massive fortune just by basically making wool from sheep, which seems preposterous, but that, you know, there it is. It was just, that's just what they did for centuries. And they accumulated all that money and then they went and conquered places and it worked out well for them. And obviously the history of the United States, the textile manufacturing plays into that because of the cotton in the South and who was, you know, doing the picking of that cotton and the working of the cotton and all that kind of stuff. So talk a little bit, and you said you've always been interested in how things are made, but talk a little bit about the history of textiles, like in the country, but also in the post-World War II period, because that's also something, you and I talked about this on the phone like 2 years ago, and I'm still fascinated by it. So talk a little bit about that.
Okay, textile manufacturing in the U.S. Well, so it's hard to know where to start, right? Which is maybe part of the reason that I'm Dungeons and Dragons lady at the moment.
But it really is a compliment, I promise you.
It's going to stick in my craw for a while. But yeah, I mean, the idea was, what fascinates me is that during the American Revolution, of course, American soldiers were not wearing American-made fabrics. They were making fabrics actually that were probably made in England, but were shipped by the Dutch over to America and then possibly sewn here, possibly sewn back there. But I mean, Americans and colonists had been forbidden from making things because the UK, the British, were textile manufacturing powerhouse. And they didn't want anybody threatening their livelihood. That was a source of that was a major source of income. So as soon as the revolution ended, Washington turned to, you know, President Washington turned to Alexander Hamilton and said, help us figure this out. Like, help us figure out how to make things. And one of the first things we needed to figure out how to make, super fundamental, hello, was clothing. Because all of our textiles basically had been coming from England. You know, that was right at the moment when people were hooking up machines to all kinds of looms and mills. And we needed to figure that out real fast. And so in the case of, in the first major case of corporate espionage, one of my neighbors, Mr. Lowell, went over to England and passed himself off as a country bumpkin and was able to memorize the inner workings of those first textile mills in England, and then brought that know-how back to right here where I am. I'm in Boston, and opened the United States' first textile mills here. And then we were kind of off and running. And yes, they were working with wool first. And then soon after, we figured out how to use the cotton gin, unfortunately. And then the North was able to exploit free labor in the South in the form of enslaved people and, you know, create cotton mills as well up here in the North. But anyway, so that's just brief background. I just wanted to make sure that it was clear. But yeah, so what happened was Americans became very, very good at manufacturing textiles. And then, and textiles, by the way, is cloth. And then there's this other part that happens when you want to wear the cloth. You could either just wrap it around yourself like a mummy, or you could hire somebody to cut and sew. And cut and sew was sped up quite a bit in the middle of the 19th century when they invented the lockstitch sewing machine. And suddenly, you know, anybody with a machine could start cranking out stuff. Then you get into the whole garment district thing in New York, where you have lots and lots of immigrant women doing cut and sew, doing tons of clothing manufacturing, and really, you know, anywhere that there were industrial centers. And that is, of course, also contemporaneous with the birth, with the real birth of the labor movement in the United States. We can talk about that. I'm sure you want to.
Oh, we will.
and we will. But fast forward to World War II. So, you know, as World War II was wrapping up, and of course, it was a devastating war, and so many people were displaced, and so many cultures were destroyed, and so many cities were ruined, not the least of which were the Japanese. I mean, the devastation brought about by World War II is you can't fathom. I mean, people were so poor and starving that they were eating rats. And America, the United States, was very concerned about rebuilding Japan and other countries following the war, because they didn't, frankly, want these civilizations to fall to bad influences again, like emperors or autocrats.
Communists.
Or communists, God forbid. And so there was a whole rebuild plan that was designed by the American policymakers even before World War II was over. And part of that was rebuilding textile and manufacturing in Japan. And an amazing number of things came out of that effort, which maybe you'd like to talk about. But one of them was that American know-how was transported or transplanted to Japan, which then came back to the United States in the 1980s in the form of Kaizen, which I'm happy to talk about if you want to. Is that where you wanted to go with this?
I don't know. You know, that's okay. Kaizen is the business management, you know, kind of theories that came, everyone thought was new, and they weren't new. They were ours with a different name, as I understand.
Right. So you and I are old enough to remember this, that back in the 1980s, when Japanese car manufacturers started manufacturing in the United States, and why were they doing that? Because the United States has set tariffs very high on Japanese autos. And so the only way that they could really viably break into the American market was by actually manufacturing here. Solved a lot of problems. So the Japanese came over and set up factories in the United States. And one of the or the main management framework that they imported into the United States was something called Kaizen. And anybody who's in production probably has heard of Kaizen, but it's basically like the concept is simple. In any business that has lots of different moving parts and different, you know, things have to add up to make something happen, any person along that line or anywhere along that line, you can find inefficiencies, you can locate inefficiencies. And the idea is to encourage the idea of kind of a flat corporate structure or flat production structure, where anybody involved in production can, you know, contribute ideas about how to make it more efficient. And, you know, so the idea is to foster community, but also to get people kind of vigilant and reward them if they do find inefficiencies, because that's what we need. We need to be more efficient. More efficiency means faster production, means more profit, or maybe safer work environment, whatever it is. Anyway, point is that whole concept was developed in the US during World War II, when American factories suddenly were tasked by the American government with producing all kinds of things in a, you know, very quickly, like Liberty ships, things that they had never produced before. And so people here, business leaders here, and production workers here had developed that concept, sent it over to Japan, and then it came back to us with different vocabulary, you know, 40 years later, and people freaked. People absolutely freaked. So if you were alive during the 80s, you might remember people freaking out about, oh, the way that Japanese work is so foreign to American workers. And what is this Kaizen stuff? And it's never going to work. It's never going to take root in America. This is too strange. We're culturally too different. P.S. This was an American concept. Hello. It was just 40 years old. So maybe that's what changed. I don't know. Maybe Americans have changed over that time, which would be an interesting study.
I think that I had Nelson Lichtenstein on the show a couple of weeks ago, who's the labor historian, and he was talking about that. Mm-hmm. And also at the time, everybody was so afraid of Japan as an economic force, you know, in the 80s, that they sort of discounted the threat of China and just sort of pivoted over that. And the Chinese really benefited starting at that time period from, you know, just us basically underestimating them, I think. And it's funny that you mentioned Lowell and the corporate espionage, because like it's always funny to me how we yell and scream about something some country is doing, and it's always something that we did like 100 years ago. You know, it never fails. You know, we're yelling at China now. You're stealing our trade secrets, and you know, we're just imitating what the U.S. did. You know, the not that that makes it right, but you know.
But that's a very important point: is that you know everything that China is doing makes sense. And you're right. Americans did all of those things at one point or another, because China rightfully is very concerned about its own people and the future of its economy. And the thing about the Chinese is that I think, or at least I've read, that they're much better at thinking long term than Americans.
No way. No way.
And
I can't believe it. We can't even wait a week to watch a fucking TV show. We have to binge the whole damn thing in a weekend. That's our culture now.
Yeah, thank you. So they seem to do they seem to have taken American lessons to the nth degree and done everything so much in some ways better than Americans have done. But we can talk about that. I didn't want this book to focus on the Chinese too much because look, already it's happening. Manufacturing is moving from China to Vietnam, and it will continue to move and move and move because the big multinational brands, and they really are monopolists at this point, the big multinational brands don't care where stuff is manufactured. They only care about profit or, you know, in keeping the cost of production low. And so that's probably the most harmful thing about globalization is that when you take these large brands, these large multinational brands, what they're doing is they're just pitting small manufacturer against small manufacturer. And then when they kind of exhaust the possibilities, then they start pitting countries against countries. And it is just an awful race to the bottom. And nobody wins.
No, it's just exploitative. And by nature, it's exploitative. One of the things that's infuriating that you wrote about in the book kind of is the book is about, we should say, the sort of through line in the book is the company American Roots, which makes hoodies. And you follow sort of the founders of the company. And it's very interesting who they are and what their backgrounds are and how they did what they did. I don't want to talk about that too much because I don't want to spoil the book. You know, I don't want to spoil the So one of the things that is infuriating about the book, right, there's a table in there where it talks about how much it costs to make a hoodie in China or in Vietnam or whatever, and how much it costs to make it here in the States. And that it isn't even really that much more expensive hoodie to hoodie. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, the thing is, whatever it is, if it's 20, it's not a lot of money that I guess, you know, multiplied over time. Sure, it's more profit, but they're making a fuck ton of profit no matter what. And the fact that they have to just fuck over the entire country and everyone living here to make a little bit more money is just, it's appalling and disgraceful. And I don't know what can be done about it, but man, it's really awful.
Well, I mean, that is true. So in the book, what you're referring to is I have a little chart about a Zara hoodie and the actual cost of a Zara hoodie and who gets paid what. So the hoodie in question is $30. I did not do this. I did not actually do the math here or the research. I was given permission by a nonprofit research group in Switzerland that actually did the study. But what they found that in this $30 hoodie, a very small part of the cost went actually to the workers who produced it. And maybe that doesn't come as a huge surprise to a lot of readers. But the truth is that, of course, those workers are not actually making what you and I would call a living wage, even within their own countries where there are currency discrepancies. But yeah, it does cost just a little more to make something ethically. So why don't we do that? And, you know, I think the answer is quite obvious, and that's that corporations, I want to make a big distinction between, you know, massive monopolists, right, and small American businesses and manufacturers.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking about Amazon and Home Depot and these fucking, yeah, okay.
Walmart, Nike, you know, the brands that everybody knows about. I mean, so the point is that when in 2023, most corporations are still operating under Milton Friedman principles, which are you are beholden only to your shareholders.
Right.
Whereas before 1970, before Milton Friedman basically gave them a theoretical framework to be greedy, there was a sense among a gentleman's agreement among American business people that they were beholden to their stakeholders. And their stakeholders, of course, included shareholders, but also included their workers and the communities in which they worked, you know, where their factories were. So there was this strong sense. It didn't last very long. I mean, but there was a strong sense in American business that lasted about 80 years that if you set up a business, you are responsible to everybody you touch. You know, from your supply chain to the workers making your stuff, obviously to your shareholders, and also to your customers, by the way, that you were producing stuff that was solid and good and would last. It's just, it was a moment in time. And I'm not nostalgic, and I don't want to be revisionist. And certainly there were a lot of problems, but it's quite clear that we have lost so much by giving that up over only the past 30 years, quite within my lifetime. This is not ancient history. This is something that just kind of, you know, happened and then spread like wildfire across the United States. It is new, and therefore it is reversible.
Yeah.
We're not that far away from a time when corporations actually felt a deep responsibility to the communities where they were and to the workers who work for them. And that's why they offer pensions, you know, instead of 401ks. There's so many ways that corporations actually helped or showed that they felt a responsibility to the people who were working for them.
And they also, to the place where the company was located, because it was located in a fucking place and not in some island that has 25 people on it. You know, I went to Pittsburgh for the first time over the summer, and that it's just downtown Pittsburgh is wonderful because they had so much money around the turn of the last century. And there's all these beautiful Art Deco buildings, and there's a set, and it's because they all invested money in the place where they lived and where their workers lived and stuff like that. And now it's just like, Elon Musk, we're going to move from California to Texas because I don't want to pay more tax. Fuck you, Elon. Go back. You're not even American, dude. Like, what is this? You know, it's there's no ethical anything anymore about as far as that goes.
Yeah. In my book, I talk about how when I was doing my research, or when I was hanging out with Ben and Whitney Waxman, who are owners, co-founders of American Roots, up in Maine. So they're just outside of Portland, Maine, in a small town called Westbrook. And the main employer in Westbrook was, I don't think still is, but was this paper mill. The paper mill is still there. They make paper. The paper mill was founded in, I think, the 1870s or 1880s. Now, I'm not going to say that paper is great, making paper is great, but Maine is a place where paper has historically been made. And it's amazing to me because when I decided to stay up there, I actually ended up renting a room in a mansion directly across the street from this enormous paper mill. And the mansion was built by the paper mill's founder. He wanted to be right there.
Yeah.
He wanted to wake up every morning, have his coffee, and this was in like 1885, have his coffee, step outside and see his workers going to work and see his factory happening and see the community that he had built. And that ain't where we are now, right? Like, people want production as far as possible from their wealth, right? You know, there's something almost dirty or un-American about celebrating making, about, you know, being there where the stuff is made, understanding how stuff is made. So I just love that story because I just think about that founder and the pride he must have felt knowing that that whole town, like, he had built that whole town, his ability to create that factory, make it run, sell the goods, was keeping all those people alive, their bellies fed, you know, the turkeys in the ovens.
Now, I think that sort of thing is just gone. I mean, the richest people in the country are literally trying to leave the planet. They want to go to Mars to get as far away from the peons and the poor people as possible. That's where we are now. It's a vast difference. It's like light years. I don't know. It's a lot. It's a long way away, you know, and I don't know. It's not great. Like this crop of rich people that we have now.
Well, I agree with you. And that's why this is somewhat of a manifesto, or actually, somebody has pointed out that it actually is a manifesto. I didn't mean to write a manifesto, but it is a manifesto with a really nice narrative and lots of historical context. But the manifesto is basically this. We don't have to live like this.
Yeah.
Right? We don't. We don't have to live like this. And there's a great end run around all of this that you and I are talking about. And that's just, you know, buying local, buying domestic, take another minute. You know, when you need to buy something, just take another minute, do a little research, see if you can find that thing made in America. It's not necessarily going to cost you a lot more. But if it is significantly more than that weird XYZ company that's selling it to you on Amazon, like, we need to interrogate that, right? So take, for example, like food containers. So OXO, OXO, they don't actually manufacture in the United States, but so maybe that's a bad example, but let me just use that for a minute because it's in my head. So they invented this pop-up container. Have you seen these things? They're like, mm-hmm. It's a plastic bin, right? It has this little top and it has a very satisfying big button that you press that like expands the base and seals it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I know okay. Exactly what you're talking about, yeah.
Okay, so I'm not crazy. Like other people use these things too, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So these things are now all over Amazon. You can buy them directly from manufacturers in China and have it sent to you. Well, great. That's fucking awesome. Because OXO invented it. That's an American company. But now you've got knockoffs being made in China that you are buying directly through Amazon, which means that every single research and development dollar that OXO spent to design and create and put into production these things is now gone. Like, you're not supporting that company. You're not supporting any kind of local manufacturers. So all of your money is just going right out of the country. And it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't. And why is this stuff so cheap? Why are those bins, the non-OXO bins, so much cheaper? Because China has a very strong, what I like to call industrial policy. It's manufacturing first policy and manufacturing specifically for exportation policy. And the idea, well, was first to, you know, build the Chinese economy, but it's had a very nefarious effect on American manufacturing because basically, the government is supporting all these small companies in myriad ways to be able to manufacture super cheap and get stuff to us super duper cheap.
Yeah.
So that ultimately the impact is we can't resist these cheap goods. And ultimately, by not buying American-made goods, we're putting ourselves out of business.
Yeah, because then there's not going to be any other goods. There's not going to be any choice. And then once there's not any choice, they'll just raise the fucking prices, which is the Amazon model. And the Home Depot model and everything else. Okay, so this is a good chance to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Rachel Slade.
Men cannot know the anguish of being ruled ineligible on anatomical grounds beyond one's control. Slaves can perhaps understand, eunuchs too, and perhaps even those doomed nobles like the deposed Emperor Romanos Diogenes, whose eyes have been put out. But not men.
This podcast is brought to you by Empress, The Secret History of Anna Kay, the new book by Greg Oliar, now available on Amazon.
If the truth is ever to be told, I am the only one left to tell it, and tell it I must.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client
the judge said, show me in a courtroom how we were at war.
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, if I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized.
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
Okay, we're back with Rachel Slade, author of Making It in America. I want to talk about Making It in America. I think you've made this point a little bit. We're talking about the Chinese and exports and imports and how the whole sort of economic system works. One of the things that comes up is tariffs and free trade and NAFTA. And these are things that I remember when NAFTA was passed. I was in college, I think, and people were talking about it, and I didn't really understand it. But it seemed like free trade seemed like a good idea because it's free and it's trade. What can be bad about something called this, you know? Like, it's pro and it's life. What's so bad? And, you know, these guys are so good with their fucking marketing with these concepts. But in fact, NAFTA just was very, very bad for American manufacturers. Talk a little bit about that. And what's also the difference between NAFTA and the Trump version of NAFTA, the name of which isn't as catchy as NAFTA?
Well, it's actually NAFTA. The new NAFTA is not actually very different from the old NAFTA. It's just got a brand new name, which I can't remember. NAFTA just rolls off the tongue. Yeah. So after Milton Friedman gave corporations permission to be greedy, then executives and got together with policymakers and started to try to figure out a system by which corporations could make things for less so that they could increase their profit and increase, payback to shareholders, which, by the way, gets reflected in your 401k. So there were several steps to getting Americans to buy this whole concept. And one was getting them off of pensions. So as soon as you are on a 401k, that means that you are responsible for your own retirement destiny. On, you know, above and beyond Social Security, right? So invest wisely or you're an asshole. Like, it's your fault if your savings fail. That's very different from a pension, which is a guaranteed income for your life, after you retire, until you die. So by getting Americans on 401k, suddenly everybody was tied to the stock market, like in a very, very profound way. That was really clever because if you had a portfolio that included big companies that, by the way, were starting to offshore manufacturing, therefore reap higher profits, whoa, look at your portfolio, it's doing really well. At whose expense? Who knows? Well, of course, now we do know. Anyway, evil geniuses, Kurt Anderson in Evil Geniuses tells the story extremely well. And that is like my Bible. I love that book. It's so well written.
It's a great book, yeah.
So well written. The guy's a genius. He's a genius, but not an evil one. Basically, Bush won, said to Congress, I am going to negotiate a free trade, or my administration is going to go negotiate a free trade agreement with Mexico and Canada. And they're going to do it behind closed doors. And you are going to either have to accept it whole hog or reject it whole hog. You can't modify it once we iron out the terms. And the terms were basically like no tariffs and no environmental or labor restrictions for offshoring manufacturing to Mexico or Canada for American companies. Like, that was it. It was just red light, red light, red light, green light, go for it. And, at the time, labor unions were saying, whoa, this is going to be a serious problem. because they already knew the corporations were so eager to get around labor requirements and labor unions, but labor requirements, you know, just OSHA, mm-hmm. you know, just like the Office of Safety and Health Standards. And so corporations were eager to get around all of the quote unquote, you know, regulations that had impeded them from making profit. And so NAFTA was actually signed and put into law when Clinton came in. And as far as I'm concerned, that's what cost Hillary the election in 2016 was memories of her and Bill, you know, supporting free trade, which then within just a couple of years, jobs were gone.
Yeah.
And the thing to remember is that, you know, we think of Detroit, we think of Akron, we think of, you know, major manufacturing cities where manufacturing just kind of evaporated and now are dangerous cities with very little, with bad economic bases at the moment. But like the thing I have to remember is that manufacturing at that moment was all over America. And that meant that there were these like one industry towns. You know, one of the towns that I talk about is Campbellsville, Kentucky, a town maybe that you've never heard of before. But in that town, there were like 20,000 people making underwear for Fruit of the Loom. That was it. That was okay. It was okay. And so the women and men who are making underwear and packaging up the underwear and doing all the things that are required to get these t-shirts and panties or whatever out the door, like they could earn a solid income, feed their children, send them to school, whatever. It was a thriving community until it wasn't. And then it was gone. So my point is, you know, there were these one industry rural towns all over the United States that were completely devastated after the signing of NAFTA because, you know, the manufacturing just left. And they were kind of like hidden. I mean, of course, the people in those towns knew the profound impact when factories closed. But because they were rural, I think it took a long time for journalists or the media in general to like really catch up on what was happening.
Yeah, sneaky.
It was kind of out of view, right? It was out of, and the same thing was happening in Maine.
Yeah. Now Maine is not close to the industrial, you know, the big cities, certainly. Now, is that where you write about the thing where the Fruit of the Loom leaves and then Amazon starts up? Is that the same town where Amazon started up?
Campbellsville, Kentucky. So yeah, this is a really interesting story. So I know a lot about Fruit of the Loom because the owners of American Roots, Ben and Whitney Waxman, who I mentioned before, ended up hiring a production specialist who had cut his teeth at Fruit of the Loom back in the 1980s. And he came into their factory, the American Roots factory, you know, what was it, like 35 years later, to try to help them figure out how to improve production. But what's funny about Campbellsville is you have all these people who are suddenly just completely out of work. I mean, I don't know what I would do. What would you do? You know, this is it. And a little known startup appears in Kentucky and they make a deal with the town and the state. And the deal is this, we're a tech startup and we'd like to settle down in Campbellsville, like set up a warehouse here and bring goods in and send goods out. And in exchange for, you know, giving these people who are now out of work, we want to get a percentage of their income tax as a reward for giving people work. I don't know if you noticed this in the book. It's a little detail, but it's absolutely fucking fascinating. So this was, I think, 1999, I want to say. So it was right after Fruit of the Loom left. And Kentucky says yes. And so this company is shaving off, like, I think 3% of income tax right out of the state, right into the company's coffers in exchange for giving people work. And that company was Amazon.
And then underpaid the people that they, you know, paid them much less than what they were making it for the loom.
Much less, because they were no longer skilled workers. When they were working for Fruit of the Loom, they were considered skilled workers. Many of them had been there for a decade or 2 decades or 3 decades. Like, they were really good at what they did. And they were actually making at the end some of these people like $30 an hour in those days. I mean, that was incredible.
That's a lot of money, yeah.
They were making a lot of money. And Amazon was never going to pay that much. So Amazon was pocketing these tax breaks, you know, for giving people work. But the work that they were giving them was moving imported crap around the country so that we could get cheap goods that were no longer made by us. So the whole argument for offshoring was, oh, look, you know, goods are going to get cheaper, which was kind of true. But the price you had to pay for it was that you would be making a lot less also.
Yeah. Yeah. It's too much math for people to understand, I think, ultimately. Same thing with the healthcare stuff. Like, you know, if you paid a little more in taxes to pay into a universal healthcare system, you would wind up paying a lot less in medical costs. But nobody wants to have their taxes raised. So no. You know, it's like, it's bizarro. It doesn't make any sense. I want to get back to something you were saying about the Clintons, because Nelson Lichtenstein, who was on, wrote a book about, you know, Bill Clinton's relationship to labor and how bad it was, both as when he was governor of Arkansas and then when he came to Washington and, you know, ran the country. And his point, Nelson's point, was that the Democratic Party needs to embrace labor, you know, to really... As a bulwark against big corporate interests, you know, that's the only other force that there is other than the government, right? And the Clintons just didn't do that. They were just the opposite. He was always distrustful of it. So I guess my question is, why do you think, because when I think about labor, traditionally, I'm thinking about not me now, but me when I'm 25 or something. My view of it is pretty negative because... the main labor disputes that I'm aware of are the baseball strike, which for me personally was, I hated it. I got some job at work, you know, some minimum wage job, like in high school for a week and a half, and I had to pay into the union. I was like, I'm going to be here for, you know, a summer. Why am I doing that? You know, and then there was always this idea, this sort of stereotype of the, you know, the labor boss guy who was overlaid with the mafioso guy. And the whole system is predominantly white. So that's my concept of it, but that isn't historically necessarily accurate. And why did I think that? And how can we fix the perception of it, I guess?
So I really want to talk about this little piece of history that not a lot of people know about, or maybe not enough people have like strung all these pearls together. So there was a big labor movement, obviously, at the beginning at the turn of the last century, and then it really took off under Roosevelt. But I mean, it became very strong during the Depression, after the Depression. But I want to talk about this other force that was growing very rapidly, and that was the mafia and the mob. And that the origin story of the mafia, and I say the mob because, like, I don't want to be racist. I mean, it was Italians, it was Jews, it was all kinds of people, right? But the origin of that was Prohibition. So in 1920, booze suddenly becomes illegal. Everybody loves booze. You know, you're not going to stop people from buying booze. And so this underground organization pops up to ensure that people get their booze. And that, of course, created winners and losers, including the Kennedys, like Joe Kennedy. He was a bootlegger. And, so you have this incredible, you know, very quickly, this incredibly strong underground organization of bad guys? I don't know. Are they bad guys? I don't know. What are they? Bad guys, good guys? I don't know. They're selling alcohol. Is that good or bad?
They're people bringing us booze is what they are.
They're people. Bartenders. Okay. Okay. Yeah. But the point is that and Ken Burns makes this point very clearly in his movie, in his documentary about Prohibition. But like, it immediately made almost every American a lawbreaker. Mm. So what you have is this underground, unofficial organization that now runs trucking. Right. And it's running nightclubs, and it's running across the border, and it's doing all these things necessary to produce and distribute an illegal good. And in order to do that, it has to pay off the law in the form of paying off police, and has to pay off DAs, and has to pay off politicians. And so it becomes a very, very powerful organization. So then 1933, end of Prohibition, the repeal of Prohibition. You have this incredibly powerful underground group now desperate for new sources of income. And they look around and what's growing? You know, what's a growth industry? And one of the major growth industries actually was labor. So labor was getting very, very strong under Roosevelt. And labor, of course, one of the strongest labor movements was right there in New York City, where the mob had been doing like a lot of the distributing of booze. Now they were moving clothing around because of the garment industry. And so they were driving. Anyway, the point is there was a lot of money in the labor movement because people were pooling their resources. They were putting it into pensions. The labor movement in New York was actually like building housing. They were developing banks. They had schools. They had all kinds of things. And the mob couldn't wait to get their hands on that money. So the mob actually played both sides. They were paid by company owners to quell labor uprisings. So they would actually go and like beat up organizers and sometimes even kill them. And then the organizers would then go to the police or the politicians and say, you know, like somebody needs to protect us. We're getting beaten up. And they were ignored. And so then they and then the mob would show up and say, we'll protect you if you let us in. And so the protection money is coming from both places, right? Like we'll protect you from organizers, and then the organizers are also protected by the mob. It was like fucking crazy. But that's how labor and the mafia and the mob start to play together in a very unnatural way. It was not desirable. Obviously, labor did not want to be contaminated by organized crime, but they literally had no choice. Their lives were at stake. And in fact, you can watch these like wonderful movies from the 30s. I need to get a list for you of exactly that happening, of, you know, good labor people getting murdered by the mob to prevent them from organizing. And then the mob ultimately taking over the movement.
Yeah, that's fascinating. But yeah, it all makes perfect sense. And you know, the mafias in Italy sprung up mostly because the people in charge of like Sicily and Naples, the actual king or whatever the hell it was, the administration was so shitty, and there was no functional law, there was no state that did anything. So whenever you have a system like that, like a vacuum of authority. Yes. Mafias come in and say, we will establish the authority. Somebody has to do it. And at least initially in Sicily, not even a bad thing. And then it grows into this monster.
But I want to be clear that that's one instance. That's garment workers, that's New York City. But I don't mean to imply that all unions were necessarily corrupt. In fact, most of them were not, and they were negotiating on good faith. And I also want to make it very clear that it wasn't just about wages. In fact, oftentimes the negotiations had nothing to do with wages. It was about working conditions, how long people worked during a day, what kinds of benefits you got when you left. You think about the broad range of the labor movement from, United Mine Workers and the struggles that they went through to just, get running water in mining villages to, now we have doctors organizing. I never thought I'd see that in my lifetime, but now because of all these managed care and these private equity owned hospital organizations, doctors are starting to realize that they're just cogs in the machine and need to organize so that they can actually, make decisions that make sense for their patients. So the labor movement has been tarnished, I think, by bad media, by movies, by a few bad apples, if you will. But but so much good has come out of the labor movement that we just take for granted these days.
Yeah, yeah, sure. I mean, the work week and the I want to go back to what you were saying about prohibition, because prohibition is so interesting to me. I read this great book about it. I think it was called Last Call. And, first of all, it didn't do anything like it was supposed to do. There was some quote of a guy who was in Detroit at the time, and he was like, it's impossible to get a drink here because there's so many people in the bar that the bartender cannot hear me yelling at him what I want, you know. And so it was mixed drinks, like cocktails, all came out of that time, because before that, people just drank whatever raw. And the quality of the alcohol was so bad that they had to futz with it to make it palatable for people to drink it. But the thing that's the most interesting is that without the suffrage movement, it probably wouldn't have happened. Like, it could get the suffrage and prohibition and income tax are all tied together, because before the income tax happened, the entire budget of the federal government was based on excise taxes on alcohol, because people drank so fucking much that it was literally could fund the entire government. And then the men were drinking too much. The women didn't like it because they were victims of abuse and they wanted the vote. And so all of this stuff happened. Boom, boom, boom. And
so are you saying it's women's fault? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying
Comes back to women.
It wasn't a fault, because they were being victimized and abused by these drunk louts. Yeah. And one of the things that did come out of prohibition ultimately is that people drink a lot less than they used to. They just do. People drank more in 1905 than they drink in 2005. It's by orders of magnitude. So it's all very interesting.
And kids were drinking. I mean, kids were drinking beer at a very young age because they were working, because, you know, there weren't labor laws for children. And so, you know, they'd get off of work and they'd like pound beers.
It's true. You got to do it. It's fun, you know. But it's just interesting because I like studying these things where there's not one group of people that wants a certain thing, which they absolutely should have, and how that affects something else, and it all gets knotted together. And then like, even out of prohibition, the people in the South that would, like, you know, most of it was about logistics and getting things from point A to point B. They had these guys that were souping up cars to make them go faster than the police cars. And like, NASCAR came out of that. Like, that entire industry came out of prohibition too. Like, there's so many things that come out of it. It's totally fascinating. See, I love when we go down these rabbit holes of cool shit. You know,
I do.
Now, this has been a great year. Now that we've dumped on labor in the past, this has been a really good year for labor. If you look at first of all, Biden is clearly very, very pro labor in a way that I can't remember another president being, at least in recently. And, you have the writer's strike, and you have the auto workers and all this stuff, and these big successes, and each one sort of, it's a domino effect in a sense. They say, oh, this worked for them, it can work for us too. And then the next thing you know, there's this ascension of what's going on. And I think combined with, things he's doing, or the Biden administration's doing, like, for example, not allowing chips to be manufactured overseas or in China anymore. So what do you make of all this? Do you think there is an upswing in labor? What do you think Biden has done to help this? Just talk about your thoughts about what's been going on the last year.
Yeah, I mean, not just the last year, but several years. I think what happened was, Ben Waxman makes this point in my book, is that workers were tired. They were tired of being exploited. They were tired of feeling expendable. They were tired of, the lack of pay transparency and lack of parity. And people are just dog tired, especially with the rise of the gig economy and shift economies and that sort of thing. And, you're my generation. We're both Gen X. And we have a tendency to just roll with it, right? We're like this weird intermediary generation where, oh, sexism, okay, yeah, I guess that's just part of, being a worker in America. That's how I lived most of my life until suddenly Me Too happened. And then I thought, oh, wait a minute, I don't have to put up with this shit, And I think it's the same with workers. And I really do believe that that people younger than us are just dog tired of being exploited. And I think a lot of that came to a head during the pandemic, when those who were designated necessary workers were also those who were the least compensated. Many of them were the mm-hmm. least compensated, least respected workers. I'm talking about warehouse workers and
cashiers at the grocery store and stuff.
Yeah. Poultry yeah. processing plants. And, you know, I would call them somewhat invisible workers, people who we didn't really think about. And suddenly they're the essential workers, right? And so I think it was just this coalescing moment when all of us began to see how connected we were, that we were all, that the many of us were being exploited for this strange economy that's emerging, that or has emerged, that is relatively destructive and undermining of our society. So what Biden has done is, for the first time, you're right, in recent memory, is that he's given the National Labor Relations Board real heft. He's giving them more money to try cases of labor versus corporations. And that means there's not this huge backlog. That means that the cases are being taken seriously. And that's sending a huge message to corporations that you can no longer fuck around, that, you know, these cases will be taken seriously. And if you do really, there's so many things that corporations are really good at, blocking organizers from coming in. If you do those things now and people catch you doing those things, like, you're going to have to pay. And hopefully the fines will be a little more punitive, and they're going to cut a little deeper than they did before. But that's one thing that he's done that I think is sending a huge message across America, especially for workers whose jobs are still here and can't go anywhere else, like doctors, like nurses. I mean, you can't offshore that stuff, like service workers. Mm-hmm. You know, they're realizing, I hope, that they have power, but they only have power if they're organized.
Yep. It's power in the union, you know? So a couple things based on the stuff that you just said. Gen X, our thing is just, it's the Richard Linklater from Slacker. Withdrawal and disgust is not the same as apathy. And that's it. You'd be like, six, we're just not going to get involved. Fuck you. That's basically the attitude that we have, you know, as a generation. I remember my first job. I think this was, I worked at an advertising agency in New York City in 1995. And I guess we had a meeting where the, you know, kind of the recruitment, I forget who it was that was talking, this woman who was kind of in charge of some management thing. And they were talking about sexual harassment. And she said, we have a problem with sexual harassment here. There's not enough of it. That's what she said. That's where we were in 1995, which isn't even that long ago, you know. And it's really remarkable how much progress has been made on that front since then, you know.
I put up with so much bullshit as a writer and an editor in my work when I worked for organizations. I don't want to say anything about where, but or when or who, but I mean, it is appalling when I look back at what I tolerated in the name of just having the privilege of being able to work in a field that I enjoyed.
Yeah.
You know, and I think part of Gen X's attitude is that, you know, look at their numbers. Like, we were so far outnumbered by baby boomers. And actually, I think the year that my brother was born, which was 1975, we had the lowest birth rate. The United States had the lowest birth rate in history, maybe. I mean, his classroom, I remember my classrooms were like half empty. There were empty chairs, right?
Yeah.
Like, there weren't enough of us to really be able to stand up to power. So the idea that we had a voice, that people cared about us, I don't know. I never felt really that there were enough of us to have a presence or to be able to make a difference or say something. Because we were kind of sandwiched between these two very large groups. And now, of course, you know, I'm sure you've seen this, colleges and universities are starting to panic a little bit because small generations make small generations, and millennials have now cycled through the educational system, and now, you know, Gen Xers kids are cycling through, and they're just frankly fewer of them because there are fewer of us. And so how are colleges and universities going to fill those seats?
Yeah, I'm going through that process now with both of my kids applying to schools. And it's interesting to see how things have changed, and how I think on some level the students have it's a seller's market, or it's a buyer's market, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, with the thing. So, you know, it is that way. I mean, the only thing that I can say, there's this book called Generations by Strauss and Howe. I don't know if you've read it. It's a very interesting book where their theory is that there's cycles of generations throughout U.S. history where, you know, one generation comes in and is like the sort of ideological, prime movers, where they establish some new way of thinking and some philosophical thing. And then the generation after that dies in the wars. And then the third generation gets all the shit done. And the fourth one is just kind of quietly like a kind of, you know, transitional thing into the next round. So the baby boomers, of course, are this generation of big thinkers and wonderful, you know, and of course, the people that wrote this book are baby boomers, obviously. So, you know,
bias.
And, you know, the thing I can say about Gen X is that historically, you know, I was afraid when that Gulf War happened, man. I was like, here we go. Here it is. But, you know, we didn't have to go fight in the wars, which was, you know, we did have that because there'd be even fewer of us then, you know.
Very true. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, this is all interesting stuff. The other thing I wanted to say about what Biden's done empowering the Labor Relations Board and getting these, you know, these law cases that will eventually go to SCOTUS, which is, if you go back and read all the skits, so many of them are this kind of thing with labor. If Trump is elected, he'll just fucking get rid of that. You know, that's dead. And
I think that's very much part of my manifesto.
Yeah.
Is, and I said this to audiences back, I want to say like 2014, and I remember the blank stares. So I'm curious about how this will land. But I said, you know, what the hell is society for? Like, what is government for? You know, why do we do anything? And my basest position, my most fundamental position is to take care of each other.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're welcome to have an existential crisis if you want to, but ultimately the structures of society and government are there to support each other as best we can. And we are a capitalist society. That's just a given. That means we use capital to exchange for goods and services, as opposed to a subsistence community or society where we exchange goods and services for goods and services. And so because we live in a capitalist society, that's just where we live. Like, we believe that money has certain magical properties. Then the burden is on capitalism to support our world, to support our communities, to support societies. And that also means working hand in hand with government to make sure that all these systems are doing what they need to do. It's simple to me. That should be our fundamental, you know, galvanizing. I don't know if you can put that into some kind of like chant or something, but, you know, what is government good for? What is capitalism good for? It's for taking care of each other. And that ultimately, of course, will include taking care of our land and our air and our water and the animals within all of that. Like, that's all, that whole ecosystem is part of us and each other. I think we're starting to see that a lot more. So why not demand that of government? Why not demand that of capitalism? And that's exactly the question. That is the question that Ben and Whitney Waxman were asking when they founded American Roots, which was, what can capitalism do that's good?
Yeah.
And what do we have to do to make that work? You know, to make this very idealistic notion work. And I say it's idealistic, but actually, you know, there was a moment very, very long ago, but there was a moment when that was exactly how American capitalists thought of their efforts. You know, yeah. They thought, we're building something. And that means we need to build everything. We need to understand how what we are doing is part of building everything that we're building.
Social responsibility is the thing. Like, I feel like, and I agree with everything you said, you know, I feel like societies always should be judged by how they treat the most vulnerable members of the society. So the idea that we're going to like privatize schools and do all this voucher bullshit and just take away knowledge from people or access to knowledge from kids, or, you know, like you said, we're not going to have pensions anymore. It's going to be 401ks, and that's eventually going to fuck, you know, who it's going to fuck over is Gen X. Obviously, we've all accepted that. We know we've been our entire adult lives has been prepared for, you know, Social Security. If there's Social Security by the time I can access it, I will be pleasantly surprised. Let's just leave it at that.
Social Security is fine, Greg. That's a red herring. Anyway.
Okay. I hope so. But I was reading I'm on this Barbara Tuchman kick because I read Guns of August, mm-hmm. but her other book one of her other books, A Distant Mirror, about the 14th century. And she's mm-hmm. writing about the societies there and how they were set up, you know, and you had these feudal lords who had the land and people would pay rent to till the land. And it was all this system of things, but there was a lot of just like raiders and brigands and, you know, basically land pirates that would come in and just, you know, steal stuff and kill livestock and burn the towns. And what the reason that all of these farmers and peasants were paying into the system was that the lords and the knights were supposed to protect them from this shit.
Protection.
So
yeah.
Ultimately, like the mafia, right? With the labor. So if the government doesn't perform that function, it is useless. It just doesn't. And provide for the common defense. I forget what document that's from, if it's the declaration, whatever, or the preamble or something like that. But that's it. And I think the common defense, it isn't just war. It isn't just foreign enemies. It's also the climate getting fucked up. It's also health, you know, isn't it? How many people died of the pandemic in the United States because of Trump and Kushner fucking up the response? You know, people were going to die anyway, but at least probably 500,000 people died that didn't need to die if they were competent. How is that? That's roughly the same amount that died in the Civil War. So how is that not providing for the common defense? Like that, I think that it is. I think having universal health care should very much be argued as something that's providing for the common defense, but that's not how it's viewed. But it's something that I think, to your point, we have to demand, you know?
I think what's happening here is what you started to talk about, which is these kind of nationless wealthy.
Yeah.
Right. And the nationless wealthy are people who, can get up and go anywhere, and they are true globalists, and they're not tied to any one particular nation or one particular society or culture. And, you know, that's what we have to rail against.
Yeah.
It's over. They don't necessarily have to rule our lives, but that means developing end runs around them. And that's why, again, I'm very focused on domestic manufacturing, because, you know, it's one thing to ask the globalists to try to manufacture locally. I don't know if they could ever even wrap their heads around it, except from a supply chain perspective. There is onshoring going on, or nearshoring going on, just to protect supply chains. I mean, but ultimately, I think that horse has left the barn. But there are all these smaller shops making every conceivable thing that you could want right here in the United States. And every time you purchase something that's made in your community, meaning the United States in this case, the dollars stay in your community. I'm sure you've heard about the multiplier effect, which is when every dollar spent in a community bounces around 3 or 4 times before leaving that community. And as it bounces around, it grows. So, you know, just a very simple model would be like, let's say you have a corner store that's locally owned and you buy a coffee there or something like that. Then you're supporting the worker who works in the store. You're also supporting the owner. The owner, by the way, has to hire a lawyer and an accountant and, you know, like a local supplier perhaps. And you can see how, you know, when you get the money in the worker's pocket, the local worker, they might go out for dinner one night or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, it stays in the community. So it's so incredibly powerful. The math has been detailed by many researchers. It's profound. The effect of buying domestically is absolutely profound. It cannot be overstated. And the effect of offshoring is profound and cannot be overstated. We've seen it in you know, the devastation that's been wrought. But I'd just like to say again, like, these are end runs around pretty horrific trends that have been going on over the past 30 years. There's a way around.
You talk about the global elite that move around. Oliver Bullough calls them moneylanders, which is a great term for what they are. They live in moneyland, you know, and they don't, like, it doesn't matter where they go. We should kick them the fuck out of the country is what we should do. You don't want to play that way? Get out. Just go away.
You know, I ended up, I was talking to somebody who I know. I know she's very wealthy. And just apropos of nothing, she started to tell me about, I think it's called a golden passport. Do you know about those?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't. So I guess for $500,000, you can buy a piece of property somewhere in Europe. And then after 5 years, you become a European citizen. And, you know, she was very casual about this. And so I went home and I looked it up. What the hell is a golden passport? And I was like, my fucking God, like, money really does buy you everything.
Yeah, no, it does. You know, it's just some of these countries, they need the capital. That's you know, Jersey in the UK is like that. You go in there and but if you make enough money, they'll just let you in and they'll do whatever you want. And that's, you know, that the service economy in the UK, it's not wool anymore. It's the service economy for these oligarchs, which is, you know, pretty awful. So here's where I think we should end. Because we're getting on, I don't want to keep you too long, although I keep you for the next another hour, because it's always such a delight to talk to you. Speaking of kicking people out of the country, immigration is a thing. And you make the point in the book, you talk about your own family and you talk about people that, you know, new Americans and how essential they are to the local economies. You know, you talk about it in the factory sense. It's definitely like that also in the sense of, like, you know, farm workers and stuff, people who, you know, pick the avocados and all that kind of stuff. When Alabama stopped migrant workers from coming to Alabama to do that, all of the fucking crops couldn't get harvested and they lost money because they're morons. But what can we do about immigration? What should the policy be? Why is, because I, you know, Trump is making this a thing now. He's railing against the immigrants. And he said they're poisoning the bloodline, which of course is something Hitler said. And
charming.
Yeah, well, you know, they seem to be scapegoated time and again during these election cycles. But yet, as he sang, as the man sang in Hamilton, you know, immigrants get the job done. So what do you think we should do about the policy of immigration? Like, what would your change be or your policy be?
Okay, well, so first of all, this whole thing about immigration, you know, Trump saying that immigration is the poison that's killing Americans, that's so effective. I just finished reading Farrah Stockman's book. I think it's called American Made. And Farrah Stockman, she's a New York Times journalist. She has a Pulitzer. And her book was fascinating because it follows three factory workers in Indiana as their factory is shutting down. They made ball bearings and then the factory shuts down. It takes place right when my book takes place. So it's all, you know, throughout the Trump administration and I think maybe to the beginning of the Biden administration. And what's interesting about her book is that in that factory, so it was Indiana and the workers were white and black, but they were Native Americans, I mean, born in America. And in that book, workers are actually being imported. So Mexicans are actually being imported into the factory to run it. And, you know, the Mexicans weren't excited about this, about the idea of taking other people's jobs. But you can imagine what the reaction was among the original factory workers, what it was like to have to retrain or to train imported workers, immigrant workers. Anyway, it was crazy. So I can really see why there's so much anger around immigrants, because anybody who's been put in that situation or knows people in that situation, which P.S. is probably a lot of the American workers who are displaced by NAFTA, That's just, I mean, I hate to say it, but that's just a dog whistle. God, I hate that. When are we going to stop saying dog whistle? I would like to come up with a new, I propose we come up with a new term. But yeah, it's catnip. Thank you. It's catnip.
Okay, catnip.
Catnip.
Dog whistle, catnip. I don't know.
Yeah, we're going from dog whistle to catnip. So it's it's just absolute catnip for people who have suffered from that situation. And my book is about a factory in Maine. So Maine is an interesting state because at the present moment, it's the oldest state in the union. I think the average age in Maine, and I'll have, fact check me on this, but I think it's like 38 years old. What's happening is that they have a pretty decent educational, public educational system in Maine. And once kids are educated, they go out of state and they don't come back generally because there aren't jobs and, you know, there aren't many urban centers in Maine. It's fairly rural.
It's cold. It snows a lot.
Not even, like, it's 50 degrees. I'm in Boston. I keep like anxiously looking at the weather. I'm like, please go down to 30. Stop, you know, preying on my paranoia that the world is ending. But, you know, when the Waxmans founded their factory back in 2015, they were quite sure that they were going to be hiring former textile and apparel workers who had lost their jobs because of NAFTA. But that's not who showed up to do the work. And it remains a fact to this day that most of the people who are showing up to do the work in their factory are new Americans. People are coming from the Democratic Republic of Congo. People are coming from Iraq. People are coming from Vietnam. All these different places. Those are the people who are showing up to do the work. And so that's who the Waxmans are going to hire. And I asked them, you know, in the beginning, I was like really surprised. I really, really was. Call me naive. But, you know, I expected when I walked into that factory the first time that I would see, you know, native-born American workers. And I looked around and no, that is not what I saw. And so I was wondering, were they selecting out, right? Like, were the wages so low that only immigrant workers were willing to do the work? Well, no, that's not actually the case at all, because the starting salary or the starting wage is something like $18 an hour now. So I think what's happening, well, okay, so you asked me about immigration. I mean, the answer is, don't ask me about immigration. I don't know what immigration policies America should adopt. I do know that we have a serious skills gap in America, that there are a lot of organizations that would like to have manufacturing here, and it doesn't work out that well oftentimes because you can't find people who are properly trained and properly educated enough to be able to be considered skilled workers. And it just takes too much damn time and too much damn work to catch a lot of people up to what's needed. But on the other hand, immigrants seem much more willing to be trained, or sometimes actually quite often, they come with the necessary training because their countries had some kind of industrial policy and some kind of mandatory vocational training. And so they're actually coming with skills. They're also coming with a desire to be self-sufficient because their whole lives, or maybe a big chunk of their recent lives, have been spent just surviving, you know, and feeling terrible about the idea that they were unable to care for their families. You know, that's an awful, awful feeling to be completely dependent on somebody else for everything. And so, you know, when I got a chance to really hang out with some of the workers at American Roots, I just heard these incredible stories. And I would love to leave you with this incredible stories of the journey of getting to this, you know, quasi-rural community in Maine and being able to work and earn a living and take care of your family for the first time, sometimes in decades. But I want to leave you with this. And it was just such a beautiful sentiment. So I talked to this woman. She's been working in American Roots now for 4 years. She has three children, and she originally came from the Democratic Republic of Congo. She and her husband met actually when they were in South Africa. They had escaped DRC, ended up in South Africa, started a family there, and the conditions were so bad. It's Johannesburg is a very dangerous city.
Yeah.
And she spent most of those 18 years, fearing for her life, fearing for her husband's life, fearing for her children's life. There was so much discrimination against Congolese coming into, you know, you're taking our jobs, you're taking our money, like all that shit happens everywhere, all over the world, that now she's in Maine. She's working, her husband is working, her children are going to school. And for her, do you know what freedom means for her? Freedom means not having to worry every minute out of every day that your children are going to come home alive.
That just gave me chills. That's why I had to pause.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think we take a lot of shit for granted here. We really do. And, you know, I hope that we are always in a place where we're able to take things for granted. That makes sense. I think that, you know, when you say Absolutely. You're worried about the end of the world or the world ending, the world is not going to end. At least it's going to be, it's not going to end before January 9th when your book comes out. But, you know, maybe soon after that, but, you know, systems can end and, you know, the way that society's function can end and capitalism could end. We don't know. You know, there's lots of things that can happen that are black swan events. But
I guess my point, though, is that, like, you know, what is America like? So I'm not chauvinistically America. That's the other thing that I just want to make clear is this book is called Making It in America, The Almost Impossible Quest to Manufacture in the USA. But I used Makenga is her name. I use her story and my story, probably your story as well, all of our stories. There is something beautiful about the idea of the United States, right? And it does often function in the way that it should, which is to provide a safe place for people who have no other place to go to survive.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, to your point, I mean, I've always sort of marveled at it because the people that come here traditionally, always really, are people, you know, that had to leave where they were before, that were minorities in the place where they were before, that, you know, were part of ethnic groups that were discriminated against or had lost in some way something. So, and all of those people come here and band together and become more powerful than everywhere else that they lived, which is, I think,
and totally they make cool. And they make us more powerful. I mean, when you think about, you mentioned Elon Musk before. I mean, like, he is an immigrant. You know, Trump's family, they were German immigrants. Everybody is an immigrant in America, except obviously American Indians who came here tens of thousands of years ago. But like, everybody has an immigrant story.
Yeah.
And for the most part, they make America stronger for what they bring to America, whether it's simply labor or ideas, which can at first maybe sometimes seem dangerous and then get incorporated into our culture. You know, obviously music, but just ideas about how we can do things differently. How we can do things better, or what is the responsibility of society to each other? You know, those are all ideas that have grown and evolved thanks to various immigrant groups coming in with their stories and with their cultures and interrogating what American means.
Yeah. Yeah. And by so doing, making us interrogate what America means. Yeah.
No, it's such an amazing place. It's such an amazing experiment. You know, I'm all for it. Like, I'm very bullish on America.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Same. You know, I'm not going anywhere. I'm around for the long haul. So again, your book is called Making It in America, which has it's a wonderful double entendre there in the title. The Almost Impossible Quest to Manufacture in the USA and How It Got That Way. Where can we find you? Are you still on the hell site? Where are you these days on social media?
On the hell site? Is that what
Twitter? Saying? Yeah.
Oh, ha. No, I gave up Twitter. Sorry. I was one of those. So I'm rachelslade.net. That's my website, and you're welcome to go there. And I'm also on Instagram. I have been starting to do a Making It Mondays, where I find a local company, meaning domestic. I say local. I guess I should be saying domestic company, and I highlight what they do so that just to kind of build our vocabulary and stretch those, you know, build those muscles about not just, like I said, when you want to buy something, when you're like, you know, I need a sweater, I need socks, or I need, I don't know, food containers or cookware, whatever it is, like, just take another minute. Just take another minute and see if there isn't a product made in America, because chances are there are.
All right. Hear, hear. So again, making it in America. Rachel Slade, always so fantastic to talk to you. Thanks for spending the time with me today.
Oh, I so enjoyed it. Thank you.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Serena Zabriskie, Marie Cast, and Martha Acuna provided the introduction in Ukrainian, French, and Spanish, respectively. Voice talent is by Stephanie St. John and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kenai Williams, Kimberly Johnson, and everyone else at MSW Media. If you'd like to support this program, get three friends to subscribe. The more downloads I get, the better the show does. You can also subscribe to The 5-8, the live YouTube show I do with my friend Stephanie Koff, a.k.a. LB. Tune in tonight for your Friday night hang. Most importantly, please subscribe to the Prevail Substack with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $6 monthly or $55 yearly subscription funds my work on the column and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely, be kind to each other, try and enjoy yourself, and until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.